This is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. I want to remind everyone that we Zoom our show on Sunday afternoon, so if something should happen Sunday night, we're not going to talk about it on Monday. But this is our Rethink the Week, and it's a great panel of three political science professors. But before we get into the Rethink the Week, I want to remind everyone that we begin this show every day with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. And I want to mention Colonel Vindman, not only because we're going to play his testimony in the impeachment hearing of 2019, but I want to use Colonel Vindman as the epitome of patriot. I want to use Colonel Vindman as the epitome of having a spine. I want to use Colonel Vindman as someone who understands that not speaking was not appropriate. Why am I saying all this? Because of Bolton and his book. Anyway, with that, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free, free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
It is our Rethink the Week. It is our Monday version. We have three great guests. Our regular Dean Spiliotis is a political science professor. Actually, he's a civic scholar and a presidential scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. He has a blog, nhpoliticalcapital.com. And if you go to New Hampshire Public Radio, usually at the end of the week, he's one of those people that sort of, you know, does their regroup of the whole week. Welcome to the program, Dean.
Hi, Arnie. Great to be here.
And happy Father's Day. And
again, thank you very much.
I can't believe I have three men on Father's Day. So actually four, ten. You know, and I know you're all papas. So yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, that's right.
Joining us from North Carolina State is Stephen Green. We have not talked to him in a month of Sundays. But not only is it great to have you back, Steve, but North Carolina is such an interesting place politically. And of course, this year, I'm trying to figure out what state isn't interesting politically. So welcome to the program.
Thanks. It is great to be back with you.
And joining us, which is something he rarely does, is Stefan Schmidt. Stefan Schmidt is known affectionately as Dr. Politics. He teaches at Iowa State. He was on with us for a short period of time on Friday, but there were sort of issues at the house and he had to go. And I said, oh no, I can't wait 2 weeks. So we got Stefan to join us for our Rethink the Week. So welcome back, Stefan.
I'm delighted. Thank you, Arnie.
So I wanted to start a little bit with the North Carolina story, in part because it's a Father's Day story. And there is a very, very important race for Congress in North Carolina, Steve. And I went to the Fayetteville Observer. And it turns out that this story hits on so many levels because the title of the piece was Renaming Fort Bragg is Personal in North Carolina Congressional Race. So this goes to everything. It goes to African Americans. It goes to, you know, Congress. It goes to electoral politics. It goes to changing names. It's just, it has something for everyone. But that includes a father, which is why it's my Father's Day story. The fight over removing the names of Confederate generals from U.S. Army bases like Fort Bragg and Fayetteville has become a national debate. But in North Carolina's new 8th congressional district, which includes Fort Bragg and all Cumberland County, the issue is much more personal. Democratic nominee Patricia Timmons Goodson, whose father served at Fort Bragg and worked her first job on the base, joined the call to rename the base. It is named after Braxton Bragg, a Confederate general usually remembered as one of the South's worst generals. Established as Camp Bragg in 1918 to train soldiers for World War I, it became Fort Bragg in 1922. This is what Ms. Timmons Goodson says. The time has come to change the names of military bases named for Confederate generals. These men have been recognized for more than 100 years. We've had many more heroes since then who deserve our respect and recognition. The military has often led in moving our country forward on issues of inclusivity. we should allow them to lead. Now, Timmons Goodson became the first African-American woman to serve on the North Carolina Supreme Court in 2006. And this is another interesting piece of it, which is where I'm going to toss to you, Stephen. She is running against Representative Richard Hudson, a Republican whose current district includes Fort Bragg, and any naming decisions, he says, should be made at the local level. So it appears that there was a redistricting on top of everything else. We have an African-American woman. We have the whole question of renaming Fort Bragg. And of course, he says, oh, it should be local, but it's a Fort Bragg. It's not a locally owned fort. In fact, it's a military base. And we have this woman who has a real connection and history to it. So it's both personal for her, but she also understands that the military was actually the first place where I think there was a sense of inclusivity. That military made a real point of bringing African-Americans in and making them part of the military family. So a little bit about North Carolina, but in part, this race sounds absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, this is gonna be a great one to watch. And you know, with the redistricting we've had in North Carolina, thanks to some successful court challenges where we were, along with Wisconsin, one of the worst gerrymandered states in the country. And now we're just, you know, at your average badly gerrymandered state. But, you know, I mean, obviously, as you mentioned, this touches on, what, 10 key issues in American politics right now.
Exactly.
You know, for me, though, it's I keep thinking about this whole moment, you know, there's the phrase, right, that the South, you know, lost the Civil War but won the peace. And, you know, they have won that since the end of Reconstruction, since 1876. And it almost seems like, as of 2020 America, that's long overdue change is finally seeming to come to fruition. And, you know, to have that symbolized in Fort Bragg, named after a Confederate general, to have a successful African-American woman running for that seat on that issue, I mean, it really does bring everything together here. And of course, it will be really interesting to see as this race takes place, how much of an issue that is and how that might affect the outcome.
Well, I know that the Democratic Party, this is one of their key red-blue districts that they're focusing on. This is like one of the top, you know, 10 in the country. So it's really important. I'm going to go to you really quickly, Dean Spiliotis, because what Stephen may not know, and I'm not sure you were on the show with us, but we've had people on the show talk about the North Carolina Supreme Court. And the North Carolina Supreme Court did something that the U.S. Supreme Court was incapable of doing. And they were able to say, there is such a thing as partisan gerrymandering. We can look at it, we can smell it, we can count it, we can measure it, and guess what? It's not legal in North Carolina. So on top of everything else, the best part of the North Carolina race, I think, is that that underlying redistricting was the North Carolina Supreme Court making fun of the United States Supreme Court because they claimed they couldn't do it, and North Carolina said, let me show you the way. So in this case, this is such a fascinating microcosm of the nation as we look into 2020, Dean.
Yeah, there are so many cross currents at work right now. The whole issue you were just mentioning of renaming military bases. There's also the debate over whether or not to remove Confederate statuary, Confederate flags. I mean, it really, all of this is really a manifestation of the intersection of the Black Lives Matter movement, a lot of the recent episodes of police brutality and the way that has mobilized people like we haven't seen in a long, long time. All of that colliding with President Trump's reelection strategy. President Trump keeps talking about protecting our heritage, and not, which is code for, you know, essentially protecting the old ways, way of life in the South.
Not touching
he's going to protect the statues. You know, these are great men. All of those kinds of arguments, and so it really is remarkable the extent to which all of these different currents are intersecting or colliding in a really volatile electoral mix. Gerrymandering, the way that gerrymandering locks in these old political relationships.
Exactly.
Et cetera, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I just want to say something, and that is that I'm looking at this, Stefan, you're going through it at Iowa State as well, because you have the Carrie Chapman Catt Center, and that is a center which was established for women in politics, but there was some provocative stuff said by Carrie Chapman Catt, not, she was the founder of, I think, the, what is it, the League of Women Voters. She was one of the big suffragists. I mean, she's an important figure, but as she was trying to sell some of the arguments, she used some racist suggestions. Am I right, Stefan?
Yeah, she basically apparently said, and now there's controversy, did she say it, didn't she say it, that segregation would be strengthened by giving women the vote. Because, why? Because she had to sell the 19th Amendment, the amendment that gave women the right to vote, to Southern legislators who had to ratify the amendment. And they were reluctant. And she said, look, you passed this and your daughter, your mother, your wife, your grandmother will be able to vote, and that'll just strengthen segregation. And so now black students once again are up in arms and essentially want to take down the name of the center, the name of the building, which is the CAT Center. I was involved about 15 years ago in the creation of that building and that center, because Carrie Chapman Catt was born in Iowa and is one of the stellar figures of the suffrage movement. Yeah. But now times have changed, and now the president of Iowa State is ducking when the protesters showed up at her presidential mansion, and it's a mansion. It's a mansion. They used to have, maybe they still do, a sommelier with a wine cellar with fine wines, and she wouldn't come out and talk to the protesters, so they were really angry at that. So this goes everywhere, doesn't it?
It goes everywhere. And so Stephen, there's a very funny military satire site called Duffel Bag. I don't know if you ever read it, but unfortunately I do. And Duffel Bag was commenting on what was going on all over the country, you know, with the protests and everything, this just sort of uproar that's happening in America. And supposedly it was a group of Middle Eastern military people that they were looking at what was going on in the United States and going, looks like American Spring to me, was what they were calling it. And let me just say something, Stephen. I've actually been thinking that. It feels a little bit like Arab Spring or American Spring, but it's different. And let me tell you why I don't think calling it American Spring is such a terrible thing. One, you know what inspired Arab Spring. They were being put down, they were being marginalized, they weren't giving rights. I mean, it was all the sort of tension that you feel now. But in most Middle Eastern country, there isn't any kind of history or underpinning to support protests. There isn't any kind of history or underpinning of being able to use the democratic process. There really isn't the encouragement. They have this thing for dictators and authoritarian figures in the Middle East. Lucky for us, there might've been a little bit, but until Donald Trump, he's kind of novel, you know what I mean? So I'm wondering, are we seeing something like an American Spring? And is there potential for this to be a real pivotal moment?
I'm glad you asked that, because I've been accused of being overly optimistic about kind of everything in life, including COVID. But I mean, as somebody who has wanted more racial equality in this life for as long as I've, in this world, in this country, for as long as I've known about the problems, I'm super optimistic. I mean, this just really seems like a moment like none other in my adult life, which I'll say is roughly 30 years now. That's a while. And, you know, just everything coming together, the Black Lives Movement building the groundwork since Ferguson, just all sorts of people building groundwork in opposition to Donald Trump. You know, the truth is, I don't know that this could be happening in the same way during a Hillary Clinton presidency. So having, honestly, a racist president in office during this, somebody willing to misuse the military in these sorts of situations, just the video after video, honestly, I think even to some degree, the pandemic, you know, like, oh my God, I can get out and go into the streets. You know, we really just do have this perfect storm of making the time for change, of an American Spring. And, you know, I will say I'll be sorely disappointed if we don't get big change out of this, because I really feel like this is a pivotal moment, that when I'm teaching my classes 10, 15, 20 years from now, that I'm going to say in that, you know, spring, early summer of 2020, the pandemic spring, that was the moment, you know, that things changed about race in this country and took a big step forward, just like we talk about 1964 and 65 and 68. I really think that this is going to be big and matter.
Well, Dean, I haven't smiled in a long time. And you know why I was smiling? Because, like a fool, I was watching Tulsa. I thought, well, what else am I going to do? I can turn on the TV, you know? And then I'm looking at the building, and I'm like, there's nobody there. And then I'm looking at the outside crowd. There's only 25 people, and they're taking everything down. And then I'm realizing, wow, maybe this is a good omen for November of 2020. But the best part, Dean, is that I then find out that it's a group of kind of nerdy, sophisticated TikTok, K-pop, you know, kids who suddenly went, whoa, we can do something because we really understand technology. It's like our second skin. But this is the better part, and I'm not giving it to Stefan. It turns out it's someone from Iowa, that actually turned the switch on. This 51-year-old woman was sitting there thinking about this, and she actually was a big supporter of Pete Buttigieg. So she put the video together, and she goes, you know, you could, like, really be disruptive. Why don't we just decide to, like, get tickets, too, so that we can go? Maybe I'll get my friends to get tickets, too. Well, this video went berserk. She put it on TikTok. I don't even know how to use TikTok. I mean, So she's ahead of me. But as a result, hundreds of people from around the country did exactly that. And Donald Trump, like a fool, was imagining a million people showing up. And look what he ended up getting. Something smaller than most rallies that you would have even in front of, you know, in downtown Manchester, New Hampshire. So to me, it speaks to a lot of things, but it also speaks to they weren't willing to risk their lives to come for him. You see, he really does think that they've drunk the Kool-Aid. He thinks they bought all the lies. He thinks that he could shoot them all on Fifth Avenue and they would still love him. And what happened in Tulsa was maybe not so much.
Well, he was angry because the public health people in Tulsa revealed that several of Donald Trump's people who were organizing this rally had come down with COVID. They announced it the day before. And so people who wanted to go went, oh, no, I'm not going to go. You know, if there are a million people coming and already a bunch of Trump's staff people have come down with it, forget about it. Trump says that's why they didn't come.
Yeah, but Dean, what I was told was that maybe the people told people in Tulsa, my understanding was he was on the frickin' plane. Dean, when all of a sudden they tell him all the bad news. Like, guess what? These people that have contracted it. Guess what? We're not doing an outdoor event because nobody showed up. And you know what? They could maybe socially distance. They could each have a row in that building because it holds like 20,000 people. And I'm not sure we're going to get that. I can't imagine his, I don't know how he pulled it off and actually to talk for an hour and a half. Because I would be a raging.
Oh, he talked for over 2 hours.
Oh, well,
so two hours. But no, the whole thing was just a disaster. I mean, it really was a dazzling fiasco at so many levels. Some of the reporting said that he wanted to do an Air Force One fly over the overflow crowd, but there was no one there to fly over, so they had to change that. They started disassembling the overflow stage at the beginning of the rally. Apparently, it was very expensive. Look like a rock concert stage, essentially. But and the Tulsa Fire Department said they estimate about 6,200 people total in an arena that holds 19,000. So you know you can't think of anything much worse for President Trump's ego and psyche. But not only the kind of lack of energy, but the message itself. If you listen to what he said, and I confess I did not listen to 2 hours of him, but I read a fair bit of what he said. You know, it's the 2016 playbook again. Only I can save you from socialism and crime being committed by undocumented workers, and people are going to break into your house and assault your family, and it's all the kinds of stuff that he said in 2016. And so there really was nothing new there. And the question is, can he put together enough of a coalition with that message a second time around?
Yeah, but Stefan, I can't believe he can. I'm looking where the numbers are spiking. They're spiking in Arizona. They're spiking in Florida. They're spiking. I mean, they're spiking in Oklahoma. And in the end, you know what? So much can be laid at his feet because even he said, although it was, I think, Trump's shtick, that, you know, oh my God, if I slowed down the testing because like I didn't want to know the results instead of what he was saying. And I know it's Trump. It was shtick. I get it. The problem is it's also what he believes.
Well, and the problem besides for Trump, the problem as political scientists always talk about this is the down ticket consequences. Because you may have a great, interesting race in North Carolina, but in Iowa, the incumbent Republican Senator Joni Ernst is now dead heat tie with the Democratic woman who was just nominated. And that in part is because they are associating Joni Ernst with Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump.
Yeah, exactly. And on top of that, I mean, it's almost like Donald Trump is flailing Stephen and doing everything possible that he can. And of course, he's got this aide de camp called Bill Barr, who will, you know, I mean, if I think that Donald Trump is nefarious, Bill Barr is smart and more nefarious. I am much more afraid of Barr than I have of the buffoon Trump, because Barr knows exactly where the bodies are. He knows how to use the legal theory like a stiletto. And what he did in New York with Berman is shocking. But on top of that, they want to move the SEC guy, or they wanted to move the SEC guy into that position. Was it the SEC? I think it was the SEC. He's not going, but that's what they want. He was, what was his position that they wanted to move him from, Dean? They were going to replace Berman with a guy who was working within the administration, had never argued a case, was a corporate lawyer. You know, I think he was doing something in corporate stuff. But you begin to wonder, why would you want to even move someone with that knowledge, except when you realize what Berman was looking at? Berman was looking at Deutsche Bank. Berman was looking at a lot of that stuff. And if anybody would make sure that that didn't come to fruition, it would be a guy with sort of corporate leanings, don't you think?
Yeah. Well, Arnie, I mean, the reporting anyway says that Trump... I'm sorry?
No, keep going.
Oh, okay, not going to happen. Yeah, just real quick, that the reporting suggested that that the Clayton, the fellow that they were going to move into the position in New York, played golf with Trump and suggested that he was interested in the position. And so they were going to move him in. And they apparently offered Berman, either the head of the Civil Rights Division in the DOJ, or to take Clayton's position as chair. He was the SEC or FTC. I don't remember which agency.
That.
So it just the whole thing is just poorly, as is often the case with Trump. There are things that he would like to do that he might be able to do, but they're so poorly executed that there are lots of unintended consequences.
Well, that's Stephen, that's DACA.
Yeah, well, I was going to jump in and say exactly that. Honestly, right. To me, the phrase of Trump's presidency comes from Ben Wittes back in spring, winter of 2017. He said, malevolence tempered by incompetence. And that is exactly DACA, right? If they had done that competently, DACA would have been struck down. There's only so much gross incompetence John Roberts was willing to tolerate on the Supreme Court. And what you look at with Bill Barr and why he's such a uniquely pernicious, horrible, awful, malevolent figure is because he is, in fact, competent.
Competent, exactly right.
And that is why he is such an extraordinary threat to the rule of law. And in many ways, you know, we have so much we're focused on right now, and rightly focused on right now, in terms of COVID, in terms of Trump, in terms of, you know, all of this stuff, that it's unfortunate that what Bill Barr is up to is largely, you know, gets lost in the shuffle. But it's extremely problematic, and one of the reasons Trump has to go.
He and Steve Miller are the most lethal in that administration.
Absolutely.
If you want to know how much destruction is happening, someday do the biopics on those two individuals, and you will be horrified at it. Ken, you want to weigh in?
Well, I was just going to add to, in addition to incompetence, you can't forget corruption and cronyism. I mean, how do you appoint somebody to be U.S. attorney? Well, I'm playing golf with this guy. It doesn't have anything to do with, law enforcement. And the guy tells me he'd like this job, and so I'm going to take him, take his word for it, and fire the guy who's actually investigating me, and bring in this. It's pure cronyism, pure enrich myself, pure save myself from any.
But you know what? I'm listening to what Stephen said, and I think it's more nefarious than that. I think Bill Barr wanted Berman out because I think he knew what Berman was going to find. And I think that this set up golf game where all of a sudden out of nowhere, the guy who has no prosecutorial background suddenly says, I think I want to be a prosecutor. Really? And in what year did you figure that one out? Oh, about maybe 30 minutes ago. And that what Barr wanted to do was replace Berman because Berman was too effective. Berman was too thorough. Berman was going to actually move this through. This guy, one, because of his corporate background, was not going to be competent. But more importantly, he was also going to know what to look for and what to protect. So I really lay this at the feet of Bill Barr, Ken, and Stefan. I'm going to say this. Barr also knew that, you know, if this guy wasn't going to leave, he was going to be fired. But wait a minute. Didn't Barr say that the president could fire him? And didn't the president say, I know nothing about it? This is Barr's turf. How can you fire someone if you don't know you're firing them?
But the president always distanced himself from every bad thing. You know, this is Machiavelli. Machiavelli said the prince should never accept blame for anything. The prince should always find somebody else and say, well, it was my associate, my assistant, my princeling. And that's what Trump does. He always pushes it off on someone else.
Mm. So, Dean, as we're looking at this, lay the foundation for what we see going into 2020. Because I was looking at an article, and we'll probably get to more of a conversation about this, that people are really angry about at AOC and Bernie Sanders because they're not spending enough time genuflecting to Joe Biden. They're spending a lot more time working in the hustings. They're working in the primaries, and they're working at the local level, and they're raising money, and they're bringing this kind of really new, interesting array of progressives into the Democratic Party, okay? Because they're actually changing the mix. Is this a bad thing for Joe Biden, or is this a good thing for Joe Biden? I'm reading like it's a bad thing, and I'm thinking they're full of crap.
You mean, is it a bad thing having more progressives being brought into the Democratic coalition?
Is that going to hurt Biden?
Well, I mean, I think the Republicans certainly hope it will. If you listen a little bit to what Trump said at the rally, that was part of the message, was that Biden is essentially captive to the left wing of the party, to progressives. And, you know, he's a puppet. I think they even use the word puppet. And so the question is that messaging in any way going to deter moderates or independents or suburban Republican women or whomever from voting for Biden? I mean, I think the sense is that to the extent that this remains a referendum on Trump, Trump's in trouble. If they can in some way make this about the potentially deleterious effects of Biden becoming president, then maybe he has a chance. So I think the verdict is still out on that. There's always been concern within kind of the mainstream Democratic Party or the more moderate wing anyway, about what kind of impact are progressives going to have. Are they going to walk? Are they going to stay home? But I think the hope among Democrats is that the focus is kept sufficiently on Trump that whatever differences there are can be put aside. But the Republicans are going to try to exploit that.
But recently a group of very progressive Democrats really went hard on Biden again.
Let's go to the break because I want to continue this conversation because I'll give you my take on the conversation because I read this article and I hear what you're saying, Dean. I hear what you're saying, that they're going to sort of attach all these liberal progressive things to Joe Biden as if it comes out of his mouth, but you'll hear. Okay, this is of a Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We will be back right after a break.
I'm going to tell y'all the same thing Sonny Lance Lamb been trying to tell you for years. Be careful how you vote. I'm warning you people, be careful how you vote. Be careful how you vote. Be so careful. But when you go to that voting booth, love and sugar don't cut your throat. The alderman say one thing, the president say the same. They about know how much money you got, can you play that game? Now I'm warning you people, please be careful how you vote.
Yeah, the one they say gonna do something for you. They wanna know if you got the vote. Can you vote for them? Have a good time, eh?
Welcome back to Parle Deux of Rethink the Week. Let me reintroduce our guests. We have Stephen Green. He is a professor of political science from North Carolina State. We have Dean Spiliotis. He's a civic scholar and a presidential scholar from Southern New Hampshire University. And we have Stefan Schmidt, affectionately known as Dr. Politics from Iowa. He teaches at Iowa State. So I'm going to tell you my suggestion, Stefan. And that's this, is that I see the investment in this progressive group not as a bad thing, but as a way to sort of flag those in the progressive camp that are unhappy with Joe Biden. And what they're saying is that if we can get our people elected, they will not be effective without Joe Biden. If Joe Biden ain't president, electing every progressive in the world is gonna have no meaning if it's Donald Trump. But if you want to affect change, not only do you start at the bottom, but this is kind of like a sandwich, Stefan. Here's one side of the sandwich, and here's the other side of the sandwich. And you know what? That's how you get a sandwich. But if you only have one side, it's open face and it ate a sandwich. And I just see that what the AOCs are doing isn't about hurting Biden. I think it's about speaking to a progressive base that you want to make sure show up in droves.
That's not what they're saying. They're not saying that. They're saying they're attacking Biden publicly and saying he needs to take a stronger position on A, B, C, D, E issues. And if he doesn't, we're going to be angry. And you know, Arnie, never forget this. The only way Biden is going to get elected is if independent voters, no party voters, swing to him and turn out for him. Otherwise, if you scare them away, it isn't going to happen. And so, you know, you got to be very careful. Biden has been very successful by staying very quiet, not taking any position on a lot of issues. And he can talk to the progressives one-on-one in the basement of his house. And he can say, I promise you this, if you vote for me and shut up and quit criticizing me, here's what I'll do. One, two, three, four. But a lot of these progressives are a bunch of dumb, stupid young people who think that you go public, that you go public and you yell and scream at the candidate publicly. Well, a lot of other people are listening besides the Biden. And when they hear too much criticism of Biden and think that he's going to be pulled all the way to the left, they're going to stay at home. They may not vote for Trump, but if they stay at home, it's curtains for Biden.
So Dean, maybe Klobuchar decided to pull herself out of the VP pick. Well, I don't blame her after what's been going on in Minneapolis. I'd probably pull myself out of the
VP. Right.
And so Amy Klobuchar pulls herself out of the VP pick because what's happening in Minneapolis, it's also exposing a lot of the time when she was the prosecutor. So it was not exactly the best moment for her because there were a lot of things dealing with, you know, police abuse that she basically never dealt with. So I'm going to turn to you, Stephen. So what I'm thinking about now is she said that Joe Biden has to pick an African-American woman. That's what she said. This is the moment. This is the time. So I am looking at everybody signaling to a little chunkette of their base, Stephen, in order to say, okay, African-Americans, this is your moment. You must vote. Then looking at the you know, Green New Deal. Okay, everyone, this is, and I hear what Stefan is saying, but do you think that people will hear Joe Biden and they'll hear the words of AOC coming out of him? I don't see that.
I mean, it's about the top of the ticket. And political scientist David Carroll, I saw, had a tweet the other day, and he said, I've long argued that if we just had a generic Democrat, you know, generic Democrat 2020, that's the way to go. And that Biden is this guy. He pointed out, if you look at the crowd, what there was of it outside the Tulsa rally, there was almost no anti-Biden, right? It was anti-Hillary stuff and things like that. They're still stuck on the Clintons. And, you know, so much of voting now is a negative action. And we are so much about negative partisanship. And so obviously there will be Republicans who hate Joe Biden for that reason, but he's just not that hateable. He's flawed for sure, but he's just not that hateable. And insofar as he's just not that hateable, and I don't think he's gonna hurt that much. The other thing I wanna say about him, and this I'll give credit to the Vox columnist, Matt Iglesias, who said, what Joe Biden has done very successfully is figure out where the middle of the Democratic Party is and put himself there. he's done that successfully, and I think he will continue to do that successfully. I think if you look, for example, with, you know, we had for about 3 days there, all anybody could talk about was, is defund the police the right terminology there? And, you know, he had this very good statement, and he's like, I am for all of these goals. These are great things. This is what we need to do. But I don't think we want to talk about defunding because, of, again, how it may scare off certain voters. And I thought, you know, kind of threading the needle there on that. And I think that is what he does.
And so what they're going to say is they're going, you know, he automatically shut down, Dean, that defund argument. He's not using the word. I'm not going to use the word. And that's one of the reasons I think he should personally pick Val Demings, because Val Demings from Florida has, I mean, she was a police person. I mean, she was a cop, you know? I mean, and she worked her way up, and she's incredibly articulate, and she's from Florida. And in a lot of ways, it's going to be very, very interesting, because there are a lot of really credible people that are out there, but she also sort of protects him with the defund the police people, because this is a person who understands, you know what? I put this on Facebook just yesterday. There was a term of art in policy. Years ago, a lot of the bills that I worked on had a provision called sunset. Remember the sunset provision, Dean Spiliotis? We don't use that anymore. But now everything's permanent, like, you know, it's cemented in stone. But we had a provision called you would sunset a bill. And that meant that at a certain point in time, if you didn't vote to approve that bill again, that law disappeared. It went poof and disappeared. And what I think is we don't want to defund the police. We want to give it some time to sort of rearrange the deck chairs. And I think what you want to do is you want to sunset them. And that means is that that gives you time to make improvements. That gives you time to make change. That makes you time to sort of take some funding away, like you've been defunding education and defunding healthcare and defunding infrastructure. And nobody goes, oh, defund infrastructure. You know what I mean? And I think in a lot of ways, that's where Joe could say, let's talk about terminology. But in the end, what do you want? You want to feel safe in your homes. You want to feel safe in your street. You want to go to a doctor when you're sick. You want your kid to be educated. You want a good job that pays the bills. So do I.
Yeah, you know, I thought just, you know, real quick, I think certainly Val Demings' stock has gone way up as a VP candidate over the last 3 or 4 weeks. There's no denying that. She's either at or near the top of the list. And I think Amy Klobuchar, I think, made a reasonable decision given the circumstances, for sure. Would have been a very problematic pick, I think, given all that's transpired in Minnesota over the last several weeks. So the issue, I think, and we were just talking about this, is a lot of the kinds of things that the Republicans and the Trump campaign are really keen on pinning on Joe Biden, like the defund the police concept, a number of other issues they were talking about, socialism, all that kind of stuff. It's just a lot harder to pin that on Biden. You know, the best they can say now is that, well, he's captive to those folks, or he's a puppet. Not that he's actually driving those ideas himself. And I think it's very interesting, the whole discussion that we heard throughout the primary season about Biden and the crime bill and his position on a lot of that stuff, we're not really even talking about that anymore. And so I think in comparison to some of the ways in which Bernie Sanders might have set up Republicans with some of these arguments, it's just a lot, there's a lot more opportunity for Biden to operate in a way that gives him latitude, not only with moderates, but to some extent with progressives as well.
All right, so Stefan, talk to me about China. How's China going to play out in this election? I can't decide what the position is. I mean, I'm like, what's Donald Trump's position on China? I think it's like Heinz 57. Name a position he's had it. And I'm trying to figure out, and what's Biden's position on China? And I'm asking you that question because you're from Iowa. And Iowa is and China are very, very important because it's your agri products that really are pivotal. And China is a big purchaser of agri products. And frankly, China owns a lot of the agribusiness. So talk to me about China and explain to me whose position is what.
Well, Governor Terry Branstad of Iowa is the American ambassador in Beijing and is a personal friend of Xi Jinping, the president of China, who came here years ago when he was some lowly officer in the Communist Party. There is a whole exhibit in one town in Iowa to the president of China because he went there and visited. And so we have a great connection. We sell a lot of our agricultural products to China. And the odd thing is that the Republicans were running some really powerful ads of Joe Biden toasting the president of China and saying what a beautiful music we've made together or something like that. What a beautiful story we've made. And it was like, well, you know, Biden, you know, capitulated as kissing the boots or the butt of the president of China. And then comes Bolton, and I disagree with everyone on this. Bolton's timing was perfect. If he had testified in front of the House, it would have been useless because the Senate was never going to convict President Trump. No matter what, Jesus Christ could have come and testified, and the Republicans still wouldn't have convicted him. So he waited and said, I'm going to time this thing so that my book comes out really close to the election, and it's going to have basically smart bombs in it that are going to hit the campaign of Trump, boom, 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 just before the election. I mean, I thought it was brilliant. And what the most brilliant thing was where he said, well, you know, I was in a conversation where Biden was saying to the president of China, would you please buy some more agricultural products so that the ag state will vote for me in the 2020 election. I mean, that should be an impeachable offense. That alone should be. And it's shocking, even in a state like Iowa, that is a shocking statement to offer a foreign leader a bribe and say, hey, you know, we'll sell you some of this stuff. Please buy it. Crazy stuff.
So Stephen, you're absolutely right. I think Jesus Christ could have come down and said something bad about Donald Trump, and Donald Trump would have held up the Bible upside down and said, but I own the book, you know, I own the book. Oh my God, we have to write the sitcom. I mean, everything he does is just so incredible because it's
Mel Brooks needs to play one of the roles.
Yeah,
there,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. But Stephen, the thing that I think is so interesting about all this is that in a way we have the win-win now. I think I'm angry at Bolton for not testifying. I think Stephen is right about the politics of the moment, okay? That Bolton's book now is a bigger bomb because now we're at the tipping point where before the Republican Party was not even imagining there'd ever be a tipping point, but now they're afraid they're gonna get tipped out of the agenda as well, and they'll go down with him. So the book is resonating. But on top of everything else, I'm a little annoyed that this guy did it because he saw the opportunity to make millions, and then the PDF of Bolton's book just got released. And I'm like, mazel tov, terrific. We can all read the book for nothing. You're not gonna even make a dime. So it's like a win, 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 win. Barr, try to stop the book now. You know what I mean? But the reason I'm bringing up Bolton is that, you know what Bolton has done? Not only is it at the tipping point, but explain to me the Lincoln Project. I have been looking at the ads of these Never Trumpers. They are the most lethal, the most brilliant, the most untargeted ads I have ever seen in my life. How come they know what to do and Democrats do not?
Maybe because they're Republicans, in a sense, in terms of, shall we say, knowing how he thinks, but certainly what they do. And I think being a small group, they're not, you know, they've got a small target. They're essentially trying to win over other dissatisfied Republicans. Yeah. They're not trying to win over Democrats who they know are going to vote or inspire them, or AOC liberals. And they can focus on that. And also, I think because of the unique personalities involved there, which are some really interesting ones, my favorite being George Conway, is on a personal level, they love to troll Donald Trump. And it's just kind of amazing. Because like the truth is, if you were running these ads widely in North Carolina, I don't think it's going to change many votes and help Joe Biden win North Carolina. But they're literally running these ads in like the Washington, D.C. market so that Donald Trump will see them and get under his skin. And they are getting under his skin. He spent apparently 15 minutes at this rally talking about why he couldn't walk down the ramp. Apparently, there are people proud of him.
Remember the water? He holds up a bunch of water.
Use one hand to drink water. America's great again.
So, this is real. I mean, think about this, you guys. This is real. This was not written as a comedy script. This is a duffel bag. You know, this isn't The Onion. And yet Donald Trump's team, he thinks he can run the playbook in 2016, but he doesn't have the villain Hillary. He doesn't have Hillary to attack. And it's like he's so miserable because he really doesn't know how to punch out on Joe Biden. And it is quite remarkable. And on top of that, we're going to have a second wave, but the second wave is going to come with the pandemic in the first wave. Because you know what they're finding out in Florida? What they're finding out in Florida, which is seeing a significant spike, is that guess what? It's people under the age of 40 who are now showing signs of being positive for COVID-19. And that's got to terrify him, because he doesn't mind the old people dying in the nursing home, because after all, you know, they're just costing us money with Medicare and Medicaid. But he cares about this kind of interesting demographic. And that's the demographic where they're seeing a spike, Dean. If he wins, I will never understand elections again.
Well, you know, I mean, it's instructive that he's, as we were talking about earlier in the show, that he is essentially running the 2016 playbook. I mean, that's mm-hmm. what he does. There's not a lot of flexibility there in terms of his approach to campaigning. I mean, the genius of the Lincoln Project, if you look at their ads, I've seen all of them multiple times, there's no policy content. They mm-hmm. went after him personally as a means of throwing him off his game. To the extent that he's, you know, has a narcissistic personality, you go after him personally, and it has completely gotten, they've completely gotten into his head. I don't even know if they're necessarily trying to persuade people on any particular grounds, maybe that he's not competent to be president, but simply by throwing him off his game and making it increasingly difficult for him to smoothly execute the playbook again, that can have electoral benefits for Biden. And also simply making the argument that these never Trumpers say, look, you know, we don't agree with the progressives. We're not Democrats. Even we want him out. So if we're willing to kind of vote for a Democrat, progressives should be able to do it as well.
Right. We can hold our nose, understand that you can too. Yes, definitely.
Imagine this, Arnie. Someone comes and insults you and says you're a stupid woman and, you know, you're fired and I don't like you. You've always been stupid. Then you hire somebody else and they say, Arnie, you're hateful. I don't like you. I'm going to quit. Trump has fired and alienated hundreds of people who now hate him. And now they love to give money to the Lincoln Project. They love to trash him. They love to say all kinds of things. And they're going to go to CNN and to the New York Times and the Washington Post and tell the story there, just because they have been treated so badly by him. He has no sense of interpersonal human relations. He doesn't understand that when you do this to people, they're going to come back at you. They're going to wait in the alley with a sharp knife for you. And Trump had better not walk by too many alleys, because they're full of people that he has been horrible to.
That's right. He lets the little people walk in the alleys. Trust me. So, Stephen, I do know how he wins. And the way he wins is actually, I think what's happening, is it in Kentucky on Tuesday, where there's like two polling places in all of Kentucky practically. And at one, there's one of the polling places, supposedly it's a polling place for 616,000 people are supposed to go to one polling place. I mean, like, what are they smoking? And obviously the intent is to be disruptive. The intent is for it not to happen. The intent is for, even if people wait for 200 hours, not to trust the results. You know that. So no matter if everyone actually gets to vote, you can't possibly imagine. And I see that being the real challenge going into 2020, is not just voter suppression, voter bottle up, the machines going down, the USPS not being able to, the Postal Service not being able to accommodate everything. I mean, think about the millions of problems we're going to have with voting, because we've already begun to experience them in every single state during the primary, Stephen.
Yeah, I mean, I think, honestly, it is more of a risk that Trump will, I'm going to put air quotes here, win through nefarious measures, through genuine voter suppression, through incompetence like we saw in Georgia, honestly, intentional malcompetence. And I think that's far more likely than that he actually gets enough votes to win 270 legitimate electoral college votes. I do think, because I'm not always on the bright side kind of person, but like, for me, like the bright side of Georgia, which was a disaster, right? Georgia is literally
The biggest turnout ever, right, Stephen?
Right. I mean, a quasi-democracy is what you call what happened with Georgia's last election, you know? But the thing is, I don't know if we're going to be ready enough. I don't know if the DNC is going to be ready enough, but right, that it was just a flashing red light, the sirens blaring, listen, Democratic Party officials, election attorneys, everybody, we need to be fully mobilized to prepare everything we can do in November. So it may happen anyway, which would be horrible, but we won't be caught unawares.
Okay, so Dean, you need to know what I did this morning. Remember, we Zoomed the show on Sunday to air on Monday. I reached out to Rachel Maddow, okay? I said, Rachel, I've never done this before. I know who she is. She knows who I am. but I've never done this before. And, you know, she says, send me tips. So I sent her a tip. And the tip was based on an interview we did last week with Ryan McCarthy from ProPublica. And I'm going to recommend, I'm going to send all three of you this article. Ryan McCarthy wrote a piece about the USPS, the United States Postal Service, and talked about the problems with the United States Postal Service. And we think, you know, we have this image of, you know, our father's postal service. Well, it has been eroded since 2006 when they started making them prepay for their pension scheme. But what he did was some of the best investigative reporting I have ever seen. And one of the things he showed us was that this is a skeleton of the former postal service. I mean, a skeleton. And they have closed warehouses. They don't have personnel. And so whenever they talk about, oh, but look at the states that are already voting by mail. If Utah can do it, if Colorado can do it, New Hampshire can do it, Massachusetts can do it, no problem. You know what he found out? He found out that those states have created relationships with the Postal Service where they literally go into the Postal Service, into the buildings, and they do sweeps looking for ballots. They go inside warehouses. They have developed such a relationship. They know where things get hidden. They know where things fall through the cracks. They have done this for so many years that they know how bad it is. So they have created a relationship to be able to actually be almost an arm of the Postal Service in order to make sure that when you put your damn ballot in, that the damn ballot comes out the other side. Does anybody know that? Do you think that New York is ready to sort of work with the Postal Service about this? Do you think Nevada is ready to work with the Postal Service about this? This is where everyone's putting their hope into expanded absentee balloting, and they're putting their hope into mail-in balloting, but everything rests on what? A Postal Service that can frickin' function. And this article at ProPublica was one of the most depressing articles, Dean, I have ever read. When I got done, I had the guy in the air and I went, I think I'm physically sick because nobody is talking about this. They're using the Postal Service as the solution, but what they haven't looked at is, will it solve anything or just create a greater fiasco going into 2020?
Yeah, I don't, you know, that's not something that people typically think much about. There's always an assumption that no matter how dire the stories about bureaucratic failure and lack of funding, that it kind of works, you know, it's always been there. Stuff gets there eventually. Maybe there's an opportunity for, you know, American democracy brought to you by Amazon. Boy, that would really get under Trump's skin.
Amazon will do it. Amazon
Prime. Yeah, brought to you by Amazon Prime.
Well, you know, so what, that's
Washington Post.
It would completely get under his skin. But not only was this story so sad, Stefan, but as he was interviewing him, I said to him, why couldn't we do this? And this is I'm going to keep saying this because I want people to hear it, because the system is so weak, the Postal Service, so weak that it will fail us. I mean, we saw it in Wisconsin. How many ballots came in, like, what, 2 weeks after the election, even though supposedly if they were postmarked, they don't even half the time postmark half the mail anymore. They don't have the machines to postmark. So you know what I said to him? I said, why don't we do this? Why don't we have a post box right next to the postal box? Except it isn't red, white, and blue. It isn't blue and doesn't say US. It says V for voting. And what you do is you put your ballot in there. You put it in every little postal, you know, office in the country. You put it next to every post box in the country. You can put it in your, I mean, why don't we do that? And that way, I mean, we'll have to hire some extra people. I get it. But you're going to have to hire extra people anyway when you want to start counting the ballots. Why don't we do something stupid like that? And what I said to Ryan McCarthy was, and Ryan, making a little metal box is not like making a ventilator. You know, I could make the freaking box. So I mean, there are simple solutions, but you can't find a solution, Stefan, if you don't know there's a problem.
Well, I've never heard this before. I don't read ProPublica because I'm busy fixing my septic system in my farm. So I'll have to go look at that article when you send it. It's a disgrace. But of course, remember, President Trump has said we need to shut down the Postal Service because they're corrupt. You know, they're losing a lot of money. They need to triple the cost of their postage and shut them down. Yeah. Shut down the Postal Service. Benjamin Franklin is rolling in his grave and is loading up his single pistol to come and shoot because the Postal Service was created one of the first bureaucracies in the country because it was the thing that connects us all. It's incredible. And nobody seems to be talking about it.
Well, and Stephen, but that is the problem. It's this reliance. It's kind of, you know what this reminds me of? It reminds me of redlined bridges. You have a redlined bridge. It's still a bridge. But what the civil engineers are saying is, this bridge is going to fall down. And then what did we see many years ago in Minneapolis? Wasn't it in Minnesota when this huge bridge collapsed? Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Why didn't I know? No, you did. You know, you just didn't fix it. You know, you didn't ask the right questions. You didn't make the requisite investments. And I see this as that Minneapolis bridge going down with the Postal Service, because this isn't just about, this is a two-week spike of millions and millions of pieces of mail from a postal service that right now, basically, they're only handing out advertisements in my box. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so I'm trying to figure out, Stephen, how we make this as important an issue in some ways as everything else we're making an issue, since the vote is so critical.
We can't. Short version. I mean, that's unfortunately, I mean, what Donald Trump has learned and his administration has learned is, here's the ultimate hack. Throw so much crap out there, be so awful that literally the entire political system and the political media is completely incapable of dealing with it. We have learned that. And, you know, the postal system is a great example. And yes, there have been people raising alarms, but there is so much. I mean, you've got the postal system, you've got Bill Barr, you've got firing people, you've got a completely catastrophic response to a pandemic. I will stop. But it's extremely concerning. And again, the fact that in this environment where we are overwhelmed by the constant awfulness and constant malfeasance of the Trump administration, it is very, very hard to pay attention to what's important and to do what's important.
And I'm going to end, Dean Spiliotis, with the last thing, because you talked about so much crap is being thrown at the wall. What happened to Voice of America last week, where they literally, Dean, they trashed it. It's gone. I mean, they're replacing it with, I mean, everybody was fired. It doesn't exist anymore. It's got millions and millions of dollars. It has a network all over the world. And he's putting in his cronies. So you know what? He doesn't want to depend on Fox anymore. He's going to have Trump of America as opposed to Voice of America. And that's what he's going to use. And nobody's talking about that, Dean.
Yeah, that's something not on the average person's radar, but it is a remarkable change and a loss of a real instrument of getting American ideals and ideas out to the rest of the world.
It's unbelievable. Gentlemen, this was an incredible conversation. Thank you so much. I can only have this once a week. Otherwise, I'm going to put me into like therapy. I want to thank Dean Spiliotis. I want to thank Stephen Green. I want to thank Stefan Schmidt. I want to thank Ken Barnes, our producer. This, of course, everyone, is The Attitude with Arnie Artisan. It's our Monday edition, Rethink the Week. We'll schmooze tomorrow. Ciao.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials, because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nub. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner, because the revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run, or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on report from 29 districts. The revolution will not be televised.